This special on-location episode of Bitch Propaganda was recorded at the Consoling Passions International Conference on Television, Audio, Video, New Media, and Feminism at the University of Oregon in Eugene on Friday, April 23rd. Just a note to our more sensitive listeners, the following podcast contains some language that could be considered questionable, including the word bitch, of course. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Welcome back to another episode of Bitch Propaganda. This is a very exciting on-location episode. I'm at the Consoling Passions Conference at the University of Oregon. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor at Bitch, and with me today are...
Jackie Cook. I'm from the University of South Australia in Adelaide, where I suppose in relation to this conference, my major role is running two programs. I'm the program director for a professional doctorate in media, culture, industry-based, with industry practitioners coming in to do a research training, and for a BA in marketing and media.
Hi, I'm Nina Hunteman. I'm from Suffolk University in Boston, and my research is around video games and the images of women and technology and so forth.
I'm Carol Stabile. I'm director of the Center for the Study of Women in Society. My research has been on media history, and I'm working on gaming, on research on gender and gaming right now.
All right, great. Well, as a lot of you listeners probably know, Bitch is in the process of putting on a symposium with the Oregon Humanities called Mad World. And we're talking about gender and advertising and new media technologies and sort of all of those intersections. And so since we're here today at Consoling Passions, which is an awesome media and feminism conference, just thought maybe I'd see if anyone had any thoughts in that area and, you know, where do you think we're going with advertising and media and gender, or what has historically kind of brought us to this point. So, Carol, I know you mentioned that you had something that came up in a panel. So,
I was at a Twilight panel actually yesterday, where they were talking about fans of Twilight. That's a different conversation. But one of the things it made me think about is how little we know about how girls in particular use media these days. And I know from my own media practices that I don't pay attention to advertising. I don't have to pay attention to advertising anymore. If I go to Hulu to watch television episodes,
right.
And more and more of my undergraduates are using Hulu, they don't watch TV. You know, they have the corporate ad at the beginning, but you don't really pay attention to that. So I think we're at this interesting moment in media history where advertising as we've known it and we've thought about it is being dramatically changed. And our consumption and relationship to advertising is also very different. And I think here of, I think we might almost want to be talking about the kinds of things that Nina talks about in her research on video games, which is, you know, things like design and content, right? Because that's where I think most of the image production is going on. And the image production that people are actually watching, because as
right.
the industry knows, right, from Nielsen data and other things, people are not watching, and the TiVo data, which has shown what we've known for years and years, which is that people don't like watching ads.
Right, if we can fast
right,
forward.
Right, if we have a choice, we aren't going to watch it.
We talked, 5-10 years ago about the kind of cross-merchandising movements, but I think that has matured to a stage at which what is really now a kind of saturational promotional culture
mm-hmm.
is focusing far more on design, on aesthetic, on kind of subcultural influences, and so on. So it's almost as though there are now no barriers at all between the commercial, the marketing, the merchandising, the retailing, and the design and aesthetic aspects. So I suppose it's a maturing, it's a total cultural convergence of all of these. They're no longer even separate media. They're just a mix of media and cultural activity. Participation is no longer something that you think of as to the side of media. It's right in there.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that struck me recently is I went to the taping of Gene Kilborn's fourth version of Killing Us Softly, which
oh, wow.
I think is available now, from the Media Education Foundation. And she said at the very beginning, I'm doing this for the fourth time. I've been working on this piece for 30 years. And sadly, not much has changed in terms of for the better. The images of women are still, you know, as she said in the first piece of the 70s, a very restrictive form of beauty, right? Super thin and tall and often enhanced, you know, through plastic surgery and flawless and all that. So in terms of the images that we're seeing, you know, they're a unfortunately, there hasn't been progress made, but I think Carol's right, is that where those images are coming up and where we're actually engaging with them, that's what's radically changed.
Mm-hmm.
The other day, I walked by an ad on the outside of, I think it was Sephora or a cosmetic store like that, and it was for some cosmetic line, and it said, achieve the flawless look of airbrushing. And I thought, wow, we have come, because the critique was, these images are airbrushed, thus they're impossible to achieve. Mm-hmm. And here's a product now that says, actually, you can achieve this fake, technologically created, you know, version of skin by using this product. And it was literally a spray on. It looked to me like you were going to spray
paint
your
face.
Yeah, spray your face. So I found that, you know, I found that sort of very interesting and frightening.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. That just made me think, like, we had a discussion last week in a different podcast about Britney Spears releasing those non-airbrushed images of herself for the Candies campaign. And it's interesting that, you know, as media consumers, I feel like, you know, we've kind of empowered ourselves more with having this knowledge of, we know people are being airbrushed, we know advertisers are trying to sell us stuff, but it's like what we're doing with that media literacy is just kind of continuing to buy into it. I mean, it's just like, oh, well, you know, she's airbrushed, so I guess I'll try to look airbrushed too, instead of, oh, I'm going to reject that image because I know it's fake, you know?
Well, I think that's one of the seductions of post-feminism, which a lot of people have talked about, and, you know, there's been a lot of conversation here, is that once you're aware of the construction, somehow you're immune to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Once you understand that that face is airbrushed, that you can somehow reject that. And that's, I don't think it's that simple. It's clearly not that simple.
And it's a reappropriation of the critique. But I think one of the difficulties was that there was always this conception that somehow or other academe was the critique, and that the industries and the professions were the producers. Well, you know, once that got totally remixed, then you can get a reappropriation of the critique into the productivity, a reappropriation of the production back into the academy. And so we have to look at our own complicity, and we have to understand it both as consumers, but as second-removed producers, the people who are producing the professionals, and also the general cultural literacies in the populations of consumers.
I think that's really true. I mean, if you teach in a professional school, you know how little this content is being taught to your undergraduates, right? You have the big lecture course on gender, race, and media, I assume, across the board. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you have very little content that really teaches future producers to be critical of the kinds of sexist, you know, and racist stereotypes that are embedded in the practices of the industry.
Yeah, and I think going along with what you were saying, Nina, with this post-feminism idea, I mean, it's also this sort of like post-modern kind of ironic. I mean, we're seeing a lot of television shows now, you know, now that everything kind of has converged, and it's like, oh, well, you're not watching the ads during the commercial breaks, so we're going to incorporate the ads into the show itself, but we're going to do it in like a wink nod kind of a way where, oh, isn't it funny that we're making fun of this? But I think sometimes then people, you know, are just kind of allow themselves to miss the bigger picture. Well, this is still corporate advertising. This is still shoving a message down people's throats that is not necessarily a positive one.
Well,
but
it's not even shoving it down their throats. It's persuading them that they really,
exactly,
in truth, do want to eat it. And it's extremely cool.
Right.
And
yeah,
as, you know, as Mark,
yeah,
exactly. And as Mark Deary once said, you know, the ironic wink and nod is very cool, but it ain't the revolution, and it's never going to be. And yeah, that's the difficulty, that this whole thing has diffused so that it's the small acts which are now as radical as an act can become.
But at the same time, we're having a very, very old conversation,
yes,
about new media production,
yes,
which is that when you don't have women and you don't have people of color involved in the production,
absolutely,
of media images,
mm-hmm,
this is what you're going to wind up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, right now we've had, you know, years and years of feminist critiques of consumption, and we still haven't managed to change the production side of things.
Yeah.
And as long as that's the case, I don't see anything changing.
And I think some of the most interesting work that's going on here is the work that is simply looking at the statistical levels of where women are working in all of these industries.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still siloed. There are still areas, key areas like distribution, where they're not represented,
right,
or hopelessly underrepresented.
Right, there's just one feminist-owned distribution company, right?
Mm-hmm. And they're already looking at the fact that distribution is occurring in completely invisible locations.
Right.
It's no longer the big industry networks. It's about deals that are being done in various places where nobody can intervene. And so I think that's the work we've got to do next, is to find out how the industries are actually operating. I'm not sure they actually know themselves at the moment.
Right, because which makes these, a good moment to...
Well, it's post-modernity. Yeah. I mean, you know, we can't think that there is a giant modernist industry out there somewhere doing all of this. Mm-hmm. It's not working like that anymore. It's even inside the big corporations, it's not working like that.
In the industry that I study the most, which is the video game industry, it has had a paucity of women working in creative roles for decades, and they're still trying to figure out how do you encourage women to work in the industry. And every time I go to a trade show or an association, Game Developers Association conference, there's always that one panel of like, how do we encourage more women to be in the industry? And it often turns out to just be, we just need to give them the self-confidence that this is a good place to work, and those colleges need to teach more science and math.
Right.
I just went to one in Boston. It did in many ways just end up with that rhetoric. It was really frustrating. But if you do look at the numbers, and I think this is what's really important, what Jackie was saying, that where women are placed, they are in the industry, but where they are is so telling. In HR, surprisingly, right?
Yeah.
And a place that I've been sort of fascinated with recently, they're in promotion, and a particular point I want to make is about the booth babe. There are tons of women in the industry in a promotional role of dressing up like these characters that are created by men, hypersexualized, to promote the games at, you know, conventions and whatnot, and then they disappear from the industry because these are temporary jobs, these are contract jobs, so they're not there. And then the other place where women have a huge part to play in the industry, but it's not one that has any kind of power, and it's not one creating the images and the narratives, is hardware manufacturing.
Oh, gosh.
Most young women in Southeast Asia are the ones who are literally putting together the Xbox and the PlayStation. So we have to ask this question that Jackie's bringing up of where are women in these industries that are creating these images?
Sadie Plant said, you know, they're still inside the machine.
Yeah.
So they're inside the corporation housekeeping the workforce, or they're actually inside the machine assembling the circuitry. But they are not actually controlling the machine or operating the machine. Mm-hmm. And that operates both at a corporate level. They're not in charge in the boardroom yet. Or they're not the owners. They're not the CEOs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wealth problem, you know, rather than an investment problem or a capital risk problem.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're also amazingly not in charge of the creative teams. And that's our image and representation problem in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, and here's a plug for Nina. Wrote a great piece about the dust up. Was it at EA Games?
Rockstar. Yeah.
And it was so telling to me because she was really talking about the structural limitations of the kinds of work that get.
Well, why don't you summarize your argument in the article? I could do it, but you could do it better than I could.
Well, again, connected to what you know, Jackie was saying about how these images are produced and who gets to control that production. There was a scuffle a couple months ago at a major game developer in San Diego called Rockstar. Well, San Diego's Rockstar. It's a huge company. It's international. They were working what's called crunch time, you know, which is extended hours a day for weeks or months on end to finish a game, Dead Redemption, which is poised to come out mid-May, and everyone's really excited about it. It's like Grand Theft Auto Western style. And once again, like we saw earlier at EA back in the late 90s, was the wives of the workers there, mostly men, complaining that they never get to see their husbands or their boyfriends, and they're not getting any support at home, and their husbands and boyfriends are coming home tired and depressed. And all of that workplace strife and quality of life balance issues, I think, points to one of the systemic problems with the industry and how they treat the laborers that makes it really unattractive for not just, you know, women, I would think anyone who is family oriented,
right,
you know, to work in the industry. I mean, the structure itself, the expectation of production, the expectation of not having a life outside of, you know, producing these games, keeps a lot of women from staying in it or even going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually classically true of all media industries. I mean, people who work breakfast shifts in radio, people who work news shifts on television, news anchors work extraordinary and curious and impossible hours, really. And so media has always eaten its workers in very bad ways, given them incredibly insecure tenure, where you can basically be moved out of your desk, out of the studio, and out of the business with 5 minutes' notice because ratings come in which are unfavorable to you. The film industry has done exactly the same thing. So, you know, suddenly you manage to audition successfully, suddenly you're on location in God knows where. And so, again, you know, family life is incredibly difficult. Always has been. And nobody has ever addressed those. It's always had this patina of glamour, which has meant that it's attracted the very best, the highest caliber professionals, and yet has abused them. And in terms of attracting women who are, you know, simultaneously trying to establish and hold relationships, these days parental responsibilities for even for middle-level executives in the industry, both downwards and upwards to their own parents, because we're getting more and more domestic responsibility, not less imposed, we've got a continuing problem. Now, that's the kind of problem that rarely gets discussed at a professional seminar.
Right, instead, oh, women need to learn math, and it's like...
Yes, you know? If only they could become self-confident enough to enter
that's
the games
right.
industry. And
right.
you know, that's not going to solve issue. Nothing. Yeah.
And there's also a discourse of competition, that if you leave this job or if you complain, there's 15 people behind you waiting to take that job.
Right. Because of the glamour.
Just
not
because of the glamour,
enough.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that perpetuates... eating, not eating their own, but eating each other. I mean, the sense that you step on somebody else's back to get ahead, and so that discourse of competition, which I've always found to be incredibly masculine, and you know, not even attractive to a lot of men,
yeah.
you know, it is the excuse of why we don't have to look at this very closely, because
we can always recruit.
Yeah.
Right, and there's no need for reform because somebody else will just go ahead and step into this shitty situation.
Yeah, there's no economic imperative.
Well, and the other thing is that those sorts of work conditions produce formulaic media content because you don't have any time to think outside the box.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that this is why the media industries are so eager about fandom nowadays, because they aren't willing to pay to provide workers with any time to actually be creative. And what they do is take advantage of fans' creativity and fans' ability to think outside the box because they're not willing to finance it themselves.
And they were hoping, of course, that this was their free innovation space, that the new, the renewal, the edgy was going to come to them free, and they would cherry-pick the best, the kind of most consistent, the most creative, the one that occasioned the biggest response. And so do no development work at all in relation to this, let alone funding any of it. So I think that there's been a lot of failure in that regard. But again, one of the things that we have to think about is that in terms of the training grounds, which are occurring spontaneously inside the culture, how do those intersect then with the credentialing grounds through the universities and the associated training academies?
Yeah.
And how does the recruitment then connect into that, including significant sponsorship and significant financial support flowing back? Because this kind of randomized and informal recruitment that's been going on is leading to the kind of professional abuse and systemic abuse that creates everything up to and including the ongoing representations of women and racialized groups and so on.
And that really means looking at it as best we can, because things are changing so quickly, the structures of industries, right? I mean, because the corporations that have managed to promote diversity and to actually promote women and people of color are corporations who've invested significant resources in making sure that happens and making sure it's a commitment from on high. And even though, you know, Hollywood and other media industries, you know, for years and years make these sort of empty gestures toward diversity, I mean, it still comes down to the NAACP boycotts. It comes down to minority broadcasters keeping track of the figures. There's no on top. They don't really care. You know, and that's been, I mean, this 2010, the first women director to win an Academy Award.
Right.
I mean, 2010, think about that.
That's quite scary.
And one of only, what, four or five nominees ever in 80 years, 82, you know.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
Just a brief insight into one of the ways in which C-level executives are thinking. My university had brought someone to school that had had a relationship with Disney, and he pointed out during a dinner that when Disney finally made the decision after how many decades to make one of their princesses, you know, a princess of color, an African American in The Princess and the Frog, he pointed out that the film didn't do very well. So shrug your shoulders. That's the end of that.
And clearly that was the reason.
And first of all, that was the reason, that maybe the story wasn't interesting enough, you know, or who knows, or they didn't put enough marketing into it.
Princess saturation.
Right, yeah.
Or just that the economy yet another means princess. People are seeing less movies.
Absolutely, all of that. Right. And then also, of course, that there's just this absolute adherence to the bottom line is the only reason why you create any story. The only reason why you put so many millions of dollars behind a narrative is if it's going to bring back financial gain. Not any discussion of morally and ethically what we're doing. And that, again, getting back to the training, that needs to be part of how you understand your position as a creative person, that you are putting stories out there that have moral and ethical implications.
Right, it's not just about what's going to make the most money.
Or even beyond that, I mean, it's that sort of corporate belief that, unless you're making a gazillion dollars in a blockbuster, it's not enough. Because I find it hard to believe.
Yeah. No profit that, margin there.
Yeah, right. There was no profit margin, given the extent of the merchandising effort and
the
all those.
The product
yeah, and
good
well.
Point.
And all those. Right, right.
Not
I mean,
just
what
the film
DVD
box
sales,
how many people are
it's not just
and,
opening season. It's
because right after
time.
It, right before it opened and right after it opened, there was a lot of publicity about how much it was making in terms of merchandising among communities of color and stuff like that. So it's interesting to hear, you know, the executive kind of back off from that, right?
But it didn't do as well as, you know, Beauty and the Beast, right? So
right, and
Avatar. It didn't do as well as Avatar,
Avatar
right? Which then
is that a new bar?
Kind
of, oh, good Lord.
Oh, clearly a storyline that really marginalizes people of color and women and is offensive for all kinds of reasons. That's the direction we should head in.
Because it made lots of money.
Yeah. I was wondering, somebody said something a few minutes back that kind of sparked my interest. You know, I think we hear a lot of kind of lip service to this idea of, yeah, we've got all these problems, but now we have such a democratic system with media production because, oh, I can make something myself and put it on YouTube. And I just think this idea of just kind of like exploiting the free labor that comes from fans, I mean, you know, where do you think we're headed with that? Are we, because, I mean, I see it, for instance, just as a blogger, which is something that's a little separate, you know. A lot of places are like, oh, we'll allow you, Forbes recently, last week, sent out a call for bloggers to blog for free on their site, you know, and, oh, we'll allow you the exposure if you write for us for free, Forbes, you know, the wealth magazine. And, you know, these, you know, gaming companies and movie production, I see Coca-Cola using student-made films for their commercials, and oh, isn't it great that a student decided to enter this contest and make our ad for us? They're not spending any money. I mean, you know, is that progress in any way?
Well, it's multiple exploitation.
Yeah.
Because, of course, not only are they taking your creativity and your intellectual product, but they are also creating an audience space, a consumer space of some kind. And, of course, you are simultaneously purchasing the electronics, purchasing the electricity.
Right.
You're
union
purchasing
busting.
All of that. Yes.
Union busting,
simultaneously.
Stealing union jobs.
It's,
right?
It's got to be the kind of design miracle of the new economy. And you almost sit there in awe of that model at some stage because it's so seamless and it ties up every possible angle. And I think we're only just, as consumers, users, participants, what are we, coming to understand exactly what's being done there. Now, I'm not suggesting that this was all conscious, but it does seem to have produced a kind of complete package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, yeah, I guess my the questions that I have, and I don't know if we can answer them, is just like, you know, are we seeing progress because of this sort of fan-made, user-made content where we see some diversity representations, or is it just kind of a backslide because that's all happening, you know, without any kind of monetary compensation? And it's not as if, at least, you know, in the small amount I've seen, that now those people are going on to be hired at the executive level of these outlets. Oh, thank you for your student film. Would you like a job at in the Coca-Cola advertising department? I doubt it.
I think this is one of the places where we need to make policy really sexy, because I think people need to realize that a lot of these concerns that you're bringing up are being hashed out in policy discourse, right, in the policy circles. So I think about the way in which IP is being, IP law is being talked about and debated and so forth. There's so much concern for protecting Coca-Cola and their brand and their trademark and what you consumer slash user slash creative can do with it. Don't you dare put this Coca-Cola logo on some parody that makes fun of Coca-Cola. We're going to sue you. That's our intellectual property, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And yet, if you create something that's within the frame of selling Coca-Cola, and you know, Coca-Cola will take that product,
yeah.
Of course, we'll take that creative labor and use it to continue to sell their products. So, you know, debates about IP, debates about trademark, copyright, they have two sides now. They didn't always, you know,
yeah.
because the user was clear and the producer was clear. But now the producer's a
right.
user and the user's a producer. And so unless a lot of, I guess, unpaid creative labor organizes itself and says, no, wait
yeah.
a minute, I've got some stuff up on YouTube, you know, I'm blogging about creating podcasts, video casts, you know, about my thoughts on XYZ, you can't just decide to tag that and put you on your site because you happen to like what I say. I want you to pay me. You know, Forbes, I want you to pay
right.
me. And
right.
that kind of organization, you know, needs to happen. Maybe there needs to be a kind of creative labor union
yeah.
for the rest of us,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
For all.
Well, and there were, right, during the New Deal. I mean, there were plenty of consumers unions and consumers organizations
and
co-ops that organized and really, you know, really made some changes for a short period of time.
So, I mean, go back to an old term that we haven't been able to use sort of since the 60s, the streamlined audience. This is the new streamlined audience. It's just been streamlined in a multidimensional way. And it's attempting to cut out all of those little excrescences, all of those little eruptions, or reappropriate them as soon as they become successful. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the Richard Florida technique about bohemianism, where you are allowed to go up to about 5% of extreme social experimentation, as long as you can always recoup it for productivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's what's happened in the world of the new media. If you can still use that term. And we haven't noticed it, and perhaps the next moment is the one where we try to actually grasp that first as a concept and then as a set of new practices, not necessarily resistive, but negotiative practices.
And I think it's important, you know, because I study media history, to keep in mind that nothing, and Nina was pointing this out, nothing is fixed now. This is a moment of great change, and moments of great change are also moments of opportunity. And so I'd hate for people to leave just feeling like, you know, they were battling the Borg or something, and we were all going to be simply assimilated. I think that a lot of these new places offer new sites and nodes for resistance,
mm-hmm.
and that we've seen some of that, and we've seen people's love of and devotion for their media products lead to some really interesting things. So who knows? I mean, all bets are off right now, I think, in lots of important ways. And so I think it's, especially for our students, a time to really encourage them to think about policy being sexy, because it's a moment in which you could have an impact on the future of the industry.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's exciting. I mean,
it's a great time to be teaching about media, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy and exciting and it's disorganized, and it reminds me more of the birth of radio than it does of
yes.
The kind of introduction of television in the United States because of the power
mm-hmm.
of amateurs,
yes.
right, and the battles that are
but
ahead of us.
If you have a look at the three kind of evolutionary stages that went through, and it went through very fast, within about
yeah.
a decade. It started with boys and their fathers tinkering in the garage, and you know, we've gone through that phase. And then it moved into commerce as industries started to realize that you can profit from this, you can turn it into something, it can be used. And then you got your regulatory phase. Well, I think we haven't yet understood the regulatory phase. And
yeah.
governments have no idea, because this is a generational problem, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So until we resolve that generational problem and start to get politically and managerially and at community level for advocacy organizations, the kind of capacity to see and actually understand the pressures,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to get a responsive regulatory framework.
Yeah.
But it's coming.
It is.
All right. Well, I don't want to take up too much time because I know we've all got exciting conference things to do. But as we conclude, if you would just want to let me know, like, one panel that you've either attended so far that you're really looking forward to, or even just one paper or a topic that has kind of, you know, really piqued your interest at the conference so far, I'm sure everybody would love to hear what all the great minds are up to this weekend.
I was fascinated by a panel that really looked at the idea of haunting and the haunted house, the haunted home, and it's the kind of dimensions or the spin that's going on because of the economic recession and the loss of the home. And so there's a kind of something translating into haunting, which is actually really the spectre of economic and financial loss.
That's interesting.
And its intersection with the kind of horror tradition. It was something that made perfect sense to me, and yet it was a completely new idea. And it's that, I think, which conferences do for you. They twist the prism. They just give you that new perspective, and you can then take it away into other applications.
The paper I've enjoyed the most so far was by Suzanne Scott. She was reporting on the response at the most recent Comic-Con about how the Twilight fans ruined Comic-Con. And of course, what that whole discourse exposed was the gendered nature of that fan space. Mm. And that, you know, fans we often marginalize, but even within fans, they marginalize each other. And how that marginalization was gendered, it was fascinating.
That was a great paper. That was a really good paper. I went to a panel on post-racial representations that was just fantastic. There was a paper that talked about Glee and the complexities of race and ability and gender on Glee that I thought was really smart. And there was also a wonderful paper about Sonia Sotomayor and the kind of wise Latina trope that I thought was really wonderful and really smart and also just very important to think about right now. And, you know, especially given the kind of backlash that followed her comments, mm-hmm. you know, about Standpoint. So.
Well, and I'm excited for more. We'll have some more updates for you, Bitch fans, the rest of the conference. We've got more coming up tomorrow. And thank you so much, everybody, for talking to me. This was so
thank
much
you,
fun.
Kelsey.
Thank you, Kelsey.
All right. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Bitch Propaganda, and thank you so much again to Jackie Cook, Nina Huntman, and Carol Stabile for participating. For more audio offerings from Bitch Media, please visit bitchmedia.org/audio.